Hey, is this thing on? Are we recording? Can I get a tech person?
Oh, for the love of ed tech.
In case you missed it, we announced our We Love Educators giveaway. This giveaway is exclusively for you, our podcast listeners. We are thrilled to be giving away some of our For the Love of Ed Tech merch, a free month of Teacher Campus, which is our online professional development platform, as well as a $50 Amazon gift card. All you have to do is go to the CET Public Television Facebook page, the Think TV Network Facebook page, or the SWTA Facebook page and share a post about our podcast with your friends.
Or write a review for the podcast on Apple Podcasts. Then take a screenshot of your post and email it to our producer, Kristen, at kteter@thinktv.org. The giveaway goes until April 22nd, 2022. Rules and regulations apply. You can view the giveaway details at cetconnect.org or thinktv.org. Thanks for supporting our podcast. We love our educators.
So I'm really excited about this. Today we're talking to David Cofield Wind, who is the co-founder and CEO of PeerGrade, as well as the CEO of EduFlow. So I'm excited to talk to him.
Can't wait to hear how he kind of came up with the idea for PeerGrade and what motivated him to develop that. And I have a feeling he has a really interesting story of how he kind of ended up in the realm of education.
And he's from across the pond. Joining us today is David Cofield Wind from Copenhagen, Denmark. And he is actually the CEO of PeerGrade. And we're going to have an interesting discussion today about his journey into the education world, as well as the founding of his companies. So welcome, David.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I am just curious, first off, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into the education world? Because I know your background is not technically like teaching per se. It's computer science, right?
Yeah. It's a good question where it even started. I think it's like a slippery slope, right? And then suddenly you're doing it. So I think it started with me teaching kind of informally during my school days, right? So I would go to school and then I would be, I think my first thing was like teaching other kids to build video games because I like building video games myself. And there was some cool summer camp you could attend to like build video games in your summer. And then I did that. And then the next year you were like invited to teach at the camp as like a facilitator or something. So I did that. And that was really fun. And I got to speak at a stage to the next cohort of kids. And then I kind of took that on and started doing workshops, building robots and programming and so on. So I think that was actually my first kind of proper experience teaching. So I'm a computer science guy, right? I studied computer science. I studied math. But I've always probably been better in the other subjects in school. I always kind of sucked at math, honestly, but I always got my good grades in like the subjects where you can like talk your way out of it. Like that's where I did the best, honestly. So yes. I think I was always fairly decent at those kind of things. So I don't know. I've always been like teaching is broad, right? What does it even mean?
Yeah,
like presenting, debating, talking is all forms of teaching, right? Mm-hmm. But then going to university, I got a chance very early, like second semester, to be a teaching assistant in a course. And I loved it. First of all, pay was great. So that was a big part of it. Second of all, it's like a really good way to like master the subject. If you kept take a course, then be the TA of the course next year, you really understood everything.
Yeah.
And so I ended up doing like 2-3 courses per semester of TAing for my whole like university degree. So I ended up like TAing everything, and that was so fun. So after my math degree, I started a PhD. I immediately realized it was more fun to teach than to do research. So I got to do my own course. And then I was like, this is much more fun, right? I like love this part. I love building the course. I'm not like, I don't know. I don't think I'm like a great presenter with like all the right jokes and like the great I'm not a showman in that sense, but like the engineering part of like building a course and picking the subjects and like building the exercises and that kind of, that was fun. And then I'm pretty comfortable on the stage. So yeah, that's how I got into teaching. I never got any formal training, maybe like a few hours, but it's always come natural to do the bare minimum at least.
Uh-huh. So I was going to say, sound like a natural.
I was going to say that makes the best. So how did you discover the importance of peer feedback? Like, what was that whole evolution or aha moment, I guess?
Yeah, it was not very, I guess the motivation wasn't so pure, right? So I was doing this course as a PhD student, and I was like, hey, I want to make this course. I think it'll be really useful, like practical applications of machine learning. It was this cool mm-hmm. big data AI course. And I thought it would be somewhat popular, but not as popular as it actually was. So it got like 150 enrollments.
Wow.
The second time I ran it. I ran it like a test one with my friends, and then ran the real version, and it got super popular. So I planned the course to be every week you have to write a big assignment and submit it and I'll grade all the papers. But if you do the quick math, I had like 40 plus hours of grading work every week.
Yeah.
And that's not fun. It's not fun for anybody, right?
No.
So I was like, shit, what am I going to do with this? So then I thought back to when I was a student, I took a course on Coursera and they had some peer review going on there. That's okay. And then I'd done some research before on like how to find fraudulent voters in voting systems. And I thought it's actually kind of like finding bad graders in peer review systems. So Coursera kind of did something cool. What if I did this for my course, but then I used my algorithm to find the bad graders and then I could like, no, I don't have to grade anymore. It was like pretty smart. So I started building this peer review system for myself as just like a way to get out of grading. I rolled it out with my own course and my supervisor, and along the way realized that this was actually really beneficial for learning, which was lucky, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't have worked, I think, if it was just for me and not for the students. Mm-hmm. They would have revolted. But apparently, I've spent the next 7 years just diving into the topic of the learning benefits here, right? But peer review was kind of a way for me to get out of grading, and then it turned out to be really impactful for the learning for the students as well.
Yeah.
So that's how I got into it, right? It was
scratching
my own itch kind of
thing. Well, you're speaking to all of us, because I always said I taught reading and language arts and social studies, and I always said the thing I liked the least about teaching was grading.
Yeah.
Just so time consuming.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people who said like, oh, really? Thanks for building a peer grade. It was really helpful. But as many people has also been like, oh, my husband or wife is a teacher. And like, thanks for building this for us as a family, because now they're going to have to spend the whole weekend grading. It sucks.
Yeah.
So, but it's always been hard, right? So like, I would go and give a workshop about peer grade and peer feedback. And then everybody would clap at the pedagogical benefits. And then after the presentation, people would come up to me and like whisper in my ear, I'm not going to grade this year. It's going to be so great. So they had all these like, nobody wanted to say it out loud, right? But it was very important for people not to actually have to spend so many hours on grading, because it's not fun, right?
It's no, it's not.
It's very hard work.
It is.
Yeah. What does peer grade look like in action? So if I was a teacher using it, what does that look like?
Yeah, I guess like from like a teacher perspective, it's somewhat similar to Google Classroom or something, right? So like it's a website, people log in, and then there's assignments, and basically you ask the learners or the students to submit something, like submit a submission. It can be an essay or a math paper or a video or whatever they want to submit. And then the submissions are then allocated to some reviewers in the class, some of the peers, right? And that's generally double anonymous, so people don't know who they're getting feedback from. They don't know who they're giving feedback to.
That's great.
And then as a reviewer, you get on one side of the screen, you see the submission, a PDF, for example. And on the other side of the screen, you get what we call a feedback rubric, which is a variation of a rubric idea that many people know. It's basically like a survey, right? Like the teacher will set up some different questions that will guide the student through giving the feedback and making it good feedback. And then you do that maybe 2 or 3 times. And then after that, you receive your own feedback. And then we call it reflect. So you reflect on the feedback actively by actually doing another level of using a rubric. So you'll see the feedback you got, and then you get to say, like, is this useful feedback? Why is it useful? How are you going to use it? So it's a very guided process to take people from like submitting to having understood and used the feedback that they got.
Okay, so how do you think that that stimulates critical thinking?
It's a funny question, right? So I think one of the things that was interesting for me was that I built this product, right? And then I went to my own class in the lecture hall and I said to them all, hey, I built a peer feedback system and you're going to give each other grades and you're going to like peer grade each other. And then they all said like, no, we don't want this. Like, this is a bad idea. And I was like, oh, no, I just built this. Damn. So I asked them, like, okay, why not? Like, come on, take a discussion with me at least. And they're like, okay, but we don't really trust each other. Right? We don't, honestly, we don't trust each other. I don't think these people in here are smart enough to grade my papers. Which is, I've done this for many years now. I still hear this every day, right? It's like the classical problem that people think with peer feedback is that other people aren't smart enough to give them feedback. So I've been working on that problem since then, and there's so many answers to that question. But this idea of, so we can get into that, right? But this idea that people don't trust their peers is actually what makes it good for critical thinking. Because when students get feedback from their teachers, they don't really read it. They just think it's true. And they say like, oh, I'm not good. Oh, that sucks. If they get feedback from a peer and they don't trust this peer, they're going to read the feedback. And they're going to think about it. And they're going to find all the holes in the feedback. And it's great, right?
Yeah.
I actually camouflaged myself once in a while as a student in the peer review process. So I would be the teacher, but they wouldn't know. And then they would like criticize my feedback massively suddenly because they didn't know it was from the teacher, right?
That's interesting.
So that is. It's very interesting. So actually, I think it's a flaw, but it's also what makes it work, that people don't necessarily trust their peers, makes them think more critically.
Jeez, yeah. That's... I don't know. That's really fascinating. And now I want to do experiments on that because it's totally true, though. I mean, I guess just like when you get feedback from the teacher, you might skim through it or you might read it or you don't.
Right.
And you say, oh, okay.
Yeah. Most people take it and they put it right in the backpack, right? Yeah. Like right. These days, if there's like a digital backpack, right?
But yeah. No room for negotiation here, right? It's kind of like... Usually,
I don't think I've ever read a piece of feedback honestly from my teacher. I've never. I get the paper. There's all these marks. That's a grade. I'm like, great. Nah, whatever. Then like, I'm not gonna.
Moving on.
And there's so many problems there, right? Like the biggest problem with feedback is not. It's another big problem. Right? People attach too much to the quality of the feedback, especially in peer feedback. Right? People will be annoyed at peer feedback because they think that the feedback they're getting is not good enough, but. The main benefit of peer feedback is giving feedback, not in getting the feedback. You learn a lot more from giving. And then it doesn't matter what feedback you're getting because that's not where the real learning is happening. And right. I think that points to another big flaw in people's thinking about feedback is that you cannot get feedback and learn from it automatically, right? You don't learn from getting feedback. You only learn from reading it and working with it and reflecting on it. And people expect like, here's learning. You're like, take it and you have a bigger brain now. Like, it's not that easy, right? You have to actually work with the feedback. And I guess the challenge there is like, if you really want to make feedback work, you have to give the students a chance to resubmit or redo their work or something with the feedback. But it's just, we don't have the time for it, right? It's so, we already have like too little time to do one submission. So now you want us to do a revision of the same submission and like, nobody has time for that, right? So, that's where the real crunch is with peer feedback and feedback in general, right? That we missed the whole important part of the feedback process, which is using the feedback afterwards, which I think is a bit sad.
Yeah, well, because if you spend the time giving it, you know, it should be used as a growth piece.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So with the collaboration piece, can you speak on that a little bit? Just like... how collaboration can happen through feedback?
Yeah, I think it's one of the things I've investigated the least with my work on peer feedback. But like there is, because there's all these like clear benefits, like, okay, grades will get higher and people will get better at giving feedback and so on. But then there's this like last note on all the scientific articles saying, and also peer feedback leads to like better collaboration and social dynamics in the classroom. And nobody really understands what's going on here. Nobody really investigates deeply what that means. But one of my reflections upon the theme is that there seems to be like a lot of things happen together in a classroom. You take a lecture together, you do group work together. But then when the grades appear, when you actually finally submit your work to the teacher, it's everybody's on their own. Like, right. Now it's not a collaborative game anymore. This is my time to be better than you. But opening up that final part of the classroom to also be collaborative, like now we also look at each other's final work and we help assess it. I think that adds like a more collaborative dynamic to the classroom that I think can help. I've at least seen my own students, this is higher education, right? But like talk to each other about the final papers and come up with better solutions together because they saw each other's work and like, oh, I saw you did this and I did that. And could we collaborate on making something even better now? And that was really cool to see them being much more aligned about grades and talking about grades and assessments. And yeah, you can have grades or not, right? Mm-hmm. Peer grade has a very loaded name with a grade in it. I don't think I would have picked that name again if I could go back. But but I think this kind of final assessment is opened up a bit.
Yeah, and it's really about changing a mindset and a way of thinking about education differently, I guess, and assessment. Yeah. So
I've gotten a lot of inspiration from this movement of teachers going gradeless, I think they call themselves, right? There's a lot of people talking about you can have no grades or you can grade less. They're kind of like a mild variation on the theme of grading less. So I think I learned a lot from different people in that community of, for example, this idea that you could have a submission with endless revisions. So it would be a course where you have to submit a final project at the end. Like that's the only thing you work on for the whole course. And you keep submitting it and resubmitting until it's good enough. And you don't pass until it's great. So like it's not like you can't pass and then be bad or pass and be good. Like you pass when you're good enough and everybody passes at the same time essentially. And you have to keep working. You have to keep submitting it until it's good enough and you'll get some people will get one piece of feedback and then be there. And some people will need 10 revisions and then be there. I like that a lot more than like, now the course is over. Some of you were really good. Some of you were really bad. Goodbye. It's like,
yeah,
much better.
There's no mastery for some of them.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's also a very different way of doing classrooms and doing teaching, I think. That's very interesting, though.
I love that, though.
Yeah, me too.
I love that whole concept. There's in the U.S. here, there's this movement toward project-based learning. And I think what you're talking about is kind of the ultimate goal with project-based learning is that continued work and revision over time. Because I think a lot of us are still that are doing the project-based learning are still doing activity-based learning, if that makes sense. So what you're talking about, I think, is the goal of that ultimately.
Yeah, and like even with my understanding of project-based learning, I think it fits very well together as well, right? Because to do this like revisions over a long period of time, the thing you're doing has to have some scope, right? It has to be a bigger project,
right?
To keep working on it and be able to like submit many revisions of the same thing. The closest you get to it in academia is like thesis projects, right? Like you have 6 months to do this project. You'll meet with your advisor every week and then you'll submit it at the end, and it has to be good enough because you don't like, otherwise you'll fail your degree or whatever, right? That's like basically the same. And you come up with the project together with me and then we work on this every week and course correct and so on. And that's super cool, right? It's the best. I loved it, right? I loved that part of my degree.
Yeah.
Especially if you get guidance from a good instructor or mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and as you're talking, I'm thinking, and this could be totally a crazy connection, but I'm thinking if I was working on a car, that same thing would happen as I'm learning. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not going to go anywhere until I have it fixed.
Yeah.
Like, and you're just going to continually try and figure out what's making the noise or what's not firing or what's not whatever, because I need the car to go.
Yeah.
Right.
And I feel like there's something that you could do universities even fully different here, right? Like, so I used to give grades for thesis projects and so on. And we would have people coming out of university that were really smart and I would hire them in an instant. And we would have a lot of people coming out of university that I would never hire in my life because they're not good enough. And then, but
they have a degree.
They all have a degree, right? So on LinkedIn, you don't know who's who. But I could just, people would ask me, oh, David, you went to this tech university, you did a degree there. Like, who's the smart? Should I hire this and that person? I'm like, honestly, I had 150 people in my class. I would hire 5 of them because the rest are just like good, but not great. And you have no way of knowing. But so I feel like we should make sure the rest get up to that level of like quality, mm-hmm. right? We should not just let them pass right. with a barely passing grade. We should like make them better and then make sure they're all, like, you will never get everybody to the same level, right? But like, right. we shouldn't have this yeah. long tail of people who are just kind of getting out of there.
Squeaking by.
Yeah. yeah. Well, and it makes everybody better
yeah.
in the long run.
Right.
You know, it benefits everybody.
Especially if you're having this peer collaboration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Maybe it's utopian. But I feel like there's at least something to do there around like putting a standard. Because this, I think the car got me to think about it, right? Because you're not going to allow a car to go out unless it's safe enough, right? You can't have...
Right.
You can have really good cars and you can have good cars, but you can't have unsafe cars in the streets, right? So we also shouldn't...
Yeah.
We need to have some level of standards that we adhere to. And I don't think all mm-hmm. institutions have extremely high lower bounds for people that they let through, unfortunately.
No.
No, it's hard.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It's hard.
It is. Well, and I want to switch gears because I want to know about AI.
Yeah.
And from what I've heard that you know a little bit about artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So I just want to know how you think that AI is reshaping the learning landscape.
Oh, is it really? It's the best question, I think. So of all the people, so I have a PhD in AI-ish things, right? And honestly, I've gotten mm-hmm. this question a lot from a lot of people, like how is AI changing e-learning and edtech and so on? And I think as somebody within the field, I think it's overhyped a little bit. The direct impact it's having on tech and learning right now. I think people love to talk about it, but there's like, what is education? How is education impacted by AI now? And then there's what's going to happen in the future. And those are very different questions because I'm very like skeptical about the current state of affairs and how much of an impact it has right now. I'm very bullish on the mm-hmm. future. I think a lot of things will change in the future. So most companies that are claiming that they use AI for doing smart things right now, they're all lying. Right? Like I have a company, I know AI. It's marketing, right? They say they do AI.
Right.
They're just sorting things and taking averages and doing very simple things, right? But mm-hmm. in the future, I think a lot of things will happen, right? So if we take it to the extremes, right, the biggest thing that will happen is something along the lines of the computer will be as smart as a human, and then it will be a personal tutor for everybody, right? That's like the end game. No teachers needed. You have mm-hmm. a robot teacher that's smarter than a human teacher. If you believe in that future, then that's kind of the ultimate experience, right? And there's a lot of research. Like there's this Bloom's Two Sigma paper. It's like an old paper where they show that private tutoring is very effective, basically, right? It's hard to beat a private mm-hmm. tutor. So, but it's very sure. it's very expensive to give a private tutor to every kid. So what if a robot could be a private tutor? That's the end game, I think. Along the way there, I don't think we'll get too much value out of this idea of like we can recommend the right resource to the learner at the right time. Here's a video on YouTube that looks like the one you're looking for. It's fine. I think that students are smart enough to search on YouTube themselves. I don't think that's the problem. Mm-hmm. So I think it's probably going to be a place where we'll see nothing and nothing and nothing and then everything all at once, I feel. It's not going to be like a gradual, slow increment towards the future. It's going to be like very nothing for a long time, and then it all happens at once, probably.
Mm-hmm. I could see that.
Yeah, I could see that too. It's really interesting. Your take on...
on all the companies being...
And the fact that... Because sometimes it does feel like that. Like, ooh, it's this new shiny thing that, oh, it can do this and this and this. And doesn't that seem so cool? And yet when you go to use it in the classroom, either one, it doesn't behave the way you thought it was going to, or it does that one thing. And then it's just kind of like, and now what?
Yeah.
Right.
I have some experience with building stuff into PeerGrade as well, right? Because all the investors we talked to would always ask me, oh, David, you have a PhD in AI, right? You surely have a lot of AI in this PeerGrade thing. I'm like, actually, no, we decided not to do that. So, but we did try some things, right? So the first thing we did was to build this algorithm that I talked about, where we would find who's giving the right grades, who's giving the wrong grades, and then we'd adjust for it, which is, if you're pitching an investor, you would call it AI. If you're not, you just call it statistics or like math. It's not AI, right?
Right.
Because if Simon keeps giving low grades to everybody, then he's probably an angry man and we should just up his grades a little bit, like adjust for the angry factor. So that's what it is, right? So we did this, and then we implemented it, and people were very confused and very uncomfortable with it because they're like, but I got a 4 here, and you're giving me a 3. Why is that? Oh, that's because we know that the anonymous reviewer is a bit optimistic or like too positive. But I got a 4. Yeah, I guess so. So like, even if the robot was right, they didn't like it, right? They didn't like, like self-driving cars,
should
right?
Should they be fine like, the other way around?
Yeah, but then the teacher isn't happy anymore. So it's like self-driving cars, right? They can be better on average, but it's not good enough. If you get hit by the self-driving car, you're going to be very mad, right? So even if I could make the average better, one student might feel cheated. And there was enough to like roll exam complaints out and everybody would be very angry that there was an AI giving them bad grades. Mm-hmm. So that was very complicated. So we rolled it back. And then what we did instead was much better, I think. So we had the system where people could flag feedback that they didn't like or didn't agree on. And then the teacher could review it, which I implemented because my students didn't like peer review. And I said, okay, here's a safety valve. I'll make a flag button you can click on. If you don't like the feedback, click the flag and I'll review it. You have nothing to lose now. You can always just flag everything and I'll have to read everything again. Luckily, that did not happen, right? Because feedback was actually...
That's what I was going
to
ask.
Yeah. That was my worry, right? But I had to give them the option. So I had to read 10% of the work myself, which was fine. 40 hours became 4 hours. So people would be very good at flagging critical feedback, right? People that were too critical, they would flag that immediately. But if people gave too good feedback, they did not flag it. So that was also very easy to catch though, right? So like two people say your work is the worst and you don't flag. And then one person says your work is the best and you don't flag that either. That's very weird. Like maybe the positive feedback here is wrong. Mm. So we had this thing called FlagBot, which would find feedback and grades that were probably wrong. But instead of correcting it itself, it would just flag it for the teacher and say, here, teacher, we think this should have been this instead. If you agree, click this button and we will do everything for you. We'll correct the feedback. We'll write the teacher has overruled this to be this. So from the student's perspective, the teacher was doing all the work, but the teacher had this like one click moderation button basically to accept all the computer revisions. And this was kind of the best of both worlds, right? So we could find all the things that needed to be changed, but it didn't come from the robot. It came from the teacher.
Yeah.
So this is the closest we got to any artificial intelligence in PeerGrade. And that's maybe that's the progression towards AI. It's like we call it human computer, something like coordination or symbiosis or whatever, right? So like the computer and the human work together to do something smart. Because the computer is not good enough to teach the kids, but it can do some things pretty well. And then with the help of a human, it can be very good, right? So maybe that's what we'll see more of.
Yeah.
But I guess you could apply this to anything, any part of teaching, right? So like picking your next syllabus, right? So here, like you put in some ideas, it generates 20 new ideas. You take the 3 best ones from that list. It generates 20 new ideas. You take the 3 best ones from that list. Or you upload a text and then the computer generates 100 quiz questions based on that text. And you pick the 10 you like and then... That's what you do, right? So it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be pretty good.
Right.
And then you are the final filter. Because selecting 10 good quizzes out of 100 is a much easier task than creating 10 from scratch.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably where we'll see most development. It won't be visible to the students, but it might be to make teachers more effective.
Which is always what you're looking for.
Yeah. It reminds me of this other question I also got all the time from investors, which was like, oh, so you have all this peer feedback data. And I guess like what you could do now is you could build a robot to give the feedback, right? You have all the training data to make the perfect feedback robot. And I said, yeah, but the whole part is they learn from giving the feedback. If I'm going to build the feedback robot, nobody's going to learn anything again. There are some fields where AI is very impactful, right? Anything with videos and so on, like analyzing images and videos. AI is very good at that. But if it's text, then AI is not that impressive right now. I think the biggest impact of AI right now would be like English papers will be written by computers and not students very soon. So the students will be using AI to generate essays. And that's possible today. And you have no chance, right? Like it cannot mimic like necessarily very high academic research, like a 10-page research paper is hard to generate. But like a 1-page sixth grade essay, no problem, right? You can do that in 3 clicks right now. So I don't know how teachers are going to deal with that there's like a robot papergenerator.com or something, and you can just go there, type in your subject, click one button, and you get a paperback.
Oh my gosh.
Well, and the kids find that out before you ever do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you're like, how do you combat this?
There's no way. I think it's like, you'll have to do very, very advanced analysis to like, then claim to the student, I don't think you wrote this, but I have no proof. It just doesn't seem like you. And then it becomes like a very toxic situation, right? How do you do that every day with every student? I don't know if that's going to be good.
I'm curious too, what is EduFlow?
Yeah, so EduFlow is...
I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's kind of the next version of PeerGrade in a sense, right? So we've worked on PeerGrade since I started it back then in 2015. Then we built on it for some years. And then we realized that a lot of things were good. It was a good product. People loved it. But there was also some things we didn't like. It was getting harder and harder to expand. Everybody liked it, but they wanted more. They wanted teacher feedback. They wanted self-reviews. They wanted a different variations of peer feedback where you didn't give feedback to the submissions, but to other people's performance and video feedback. And like, you name it, right? So all these different like, slightly different things than what we're supposed to do. And then we were also a bit annoyed that when we had to like go out and sell PeerGrade, we didn't have to sell software. We had to sell a new way to teach. And then if people bought that, then they would buy the software as well. But then, so that was fine, right? I went and did like 1,000 workshops about peer feedback, pedagogical possibilities with peer feedback. But then I'd go to university, I would do this workshop. They would say, wow, that's cool. I think we should test this out next fall. Okay, it's so like in a year, you're going to test this in your course. And then a year after that, you maybe buy a license for this. This will never work. Like this is for a business. This is not, this is not going to work, right? It was doing okay. It's like a sustainable business and it's still growing PeerGrade. But we thought, okay, we want to do something bigger. So we started from scratch. We started from nothing. And then we built a new product, EduFlow, which is a kind of like a learning management system, right? It can like run your whole course. It can also do all the things PeerGrade can do, because that's what all of our customers were doing. So it has a ton of peer feedback and feedback capabilities, but it can also do quizzes and content delivery and discussion forums and everything. So it's a learning platform that is built heavily around collaborative active learning. So online courses that are more than videos and quizzes is kind of what we branded as, right? If you want your online course to involve collaboration and so on, then EduFlow might be the right platform to host it on.
Oh, cool. So fun new journey.
Yeah. And we also just wanted to build something new. We like building, right? So we're like, we're doing this. Yeah. We don't owe anybody anything. We can do what we want. Like we liked PeerGrade, but now we want to build this new thing. So PeerGrade still exists, but people have started adopting EduFlow instead now. But for the same reasons, right? If you go to the PeerGrade website, there's a big link at the top that says, hey, check out EduFlow as well, because this is what we're doing now. We're not shutting PeerGrade down, at least not for now. But we do think, since we haven't worked too much on PeerGrade in the last years, if they want to do peer feedback and they like PeerGrade, then they should probably do the same just on EduFlow.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Okay, so turn in the corner. I'm going 90 degrees. I want to know from you, either to a kid that has your same interest, like is maybe going to those summer camps and building robots, or to a teacher who has you in their class, what advice do you have to encourage that growth and like learning for technology, really, overall?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I got better and better at school from like I started until I finished. I was really sucked in the early classes at all the things that I barely passed math in public school. I barely passed math. I was the worst in math, I think, in my whole high school class. And now I have a PhD in math, right? So like I apparently could do it, but it was not clear in the beginning. And I think what changed from beginning to end was more and more freedom to do your own projects, do the things you cared about, and not like road multiplication with no books open kind of stuff. I'm still not good at that, right? I still cannot divide without a calculator, right? I don't know how to do long division. It does not hold me back from doing a PhD in math, right? So I'm not against fundamentals. You should learn some of those things because it will make you better at math. But I think there has to be a balance where some kids are just not very good at those simple arithmetic things, for example, or grammar or whatever this like corresponding thing is, But they actually have some things on the other end. They might be good thinkers, or they might be good at debating, or they might be good at like telling stories or something, right? So I think that's important to remember. And I think it's important not to like whack them down too early, because they don't know the fundamentals and they aren't very good at it. And then I think I had some good teachers along the way, and they were, I like computers, right? I was like a little hacker kid, right? I would like be the one that broke the computer in the library and like send dirty messages out on the computer network and all of the bad things, right? And I think as much as like people would always find out and like bring me to the principal, they were always like, David, don't do this, but also, well done. Like, this is like quite cool. Like, you're like, you're clearly smart.
Kind of impressive.
Yeah. So like, we're not going to like, you can still use the computers, but like, don't do this again. So they're always kind of overbearing. I think that's important, because I think kids are stupid, right? Kids do stupid things all the time. And I think they don't know how to use these skills they have for good things in the beginning, right? They just want to delete all the important files in the computer and make it break. And my dad, you said, please don't do that again. And he got the files back, right? So I think giving them opportunities to do bad things and fail and then not destroying the adventure for them is important.
Do you remember what age you were exposed to computer science?
I've tried to figure it out, but I think it's slippery slope as well, right? So like, I remember we got a computer when I was very little. I don't know why. Like, my dad was, he really liked computers, but he was never a programmer. He's never programmed anything, I think. But he just bought a very expensive computer, and then I played with it. I played games on the old computer, right? And on Windows DOS back then. So I played with it, and then I remember my first memory of like real programming is like we're on a vacation, a summer vacation as a kid in Thailand, and I'm sitting in the lobby of the hotel with a big book about Java programming, and I don't know what's going on here, but like I definitely know that that was more interesting than the pool at the hotel. But I think it was, I actually think it was when I went to, I think I was in the middle of school, right, like sixth grade or something. We went to this after school club where you could go after school and then you could like play football or computer games or whatever. And there was the computer guy there, Michael. He was sitting in the corner doing his computer stuff. And I walked over to him one day and asked what he was doing. And I looked at his computer and he had Notepad open on his computer. And Notepad was the product, you could just write text in it. But he had this like gibberish code-like thing in there. And I was like, what is this, Michael? And he said, that's the website for the club here. And I was like, it just blew my mind. Like, what do you mean it's the website in Notepad? And then he told me that there is computer code and so on. And then I think me and my good friend back then, we started like, his big brother had a computer programming book or something. That's how it all started, right? So I had a lot of like extracurricular activities back then where I had like, where I met with older people who had experience and were also nerds. And they inspired me a lot more than my actual teachers, right? It was Michael at the computer club and Henrik at the after school computer club. And like, there was all these other people actually who were randomly there, but they had a big inspiration on me, I think.
Yeah. I think that's really important too.
It is. And I think that's what I try to do with these, like teaching kids computer games myself, right? It's like, don't learn about programming from like, here, we're going to start with the 101 version of programming. Right. Like, no, go to this cool club where young kids will be there like you, just a little bit older, and you'll build a robot on your first day that will drive around the library and make noises. Like, that should be your first exposure to programming, not a book about programming.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed our discussion today. If you like our podcast, please don't forget to subscribe to get notified when new episodes are released.
For more information about our podcast and to access links and resources referenced in this episode, check us out at fortheloveofedtech.org.